Bishop Prokin, we read about different things. One of the Inyadim, for example, it starts by telling us what are some of those special occasions when the Kohanim go up to Duchen, even up to four times during the course of the day. And we learned when, of course, this is particularly applicable in Eretz Yisrael to this very day, where Kohanim Duchen, and in Yerushalayim, for example, because of this, the Kohanim Duchen every single day. So at what services do they duchen, and you know, when don't they duchen, so, okay? And then we learned about the institution of the Mishmoros and the Ma'amodos, whereby the entire community of Jews living in Eretz Yisrael had their share in the daily temple services. And they had their representatives from each community, and each one was assigned in rotation a time to come to the Beis HaMikdash. And therefore, we realize that the various sacrifices performed on behalf of the people of Israel really were representative for the entire people. And then, finally, we read also what are the special readings of the Torah that they read on those days. And then we finally wound up with the last Mishnayos in the particular tractate, one of them dealing with Shavuot Tammuz. What are the various events that took place on that day of mourning, on that day of fasting, and Tisha B'Av, wherein we learned not only about the disasters of that day, but also how should we observe Tisha B'Av, and how in general should we observe the month of Av, and the differences of opinion over there as to what restrictions we have, as to the time when we have restrictions and things like that. But practices that we observe to this very day are based upon what we learned in the past few weeks. And finally, there is one holiday left over, and that's what we're going to learn about tonight in the concluding portion of Tanis. Before we begin, I'd like again to express, first of all, my appreciation not only to my Talmidim for coming with such faithfulness in order to come participate, to learn the Word of God, but also my appreciation to Rabbi Weisfogel, to Rabbi Sonnenschein, who have set a standard for love of Torah in our community, and the fact that education is to be not just the share of our young people, but is to be the share of every adult in our community. And we hope that the Chol B'nayach Levudei Hashem, that all your children will be taught of the Lord, they will all be learning the Word of God, Barab Shlom B'nayach, so that the peace of your children will be great. This is what we hope that we pray for. And now, the last section, okay? The Mishnah says, Omer Rab Shimon ben Gamliel says, Lo yihayu yomim tovim liYisrael kachamisha osa ba'avik hayom ha-kippurim. Rab Shimon Gamliel said that the people of Israel never had such joyous festivals as the 15th day of Av and Yom Kippur. If I would ask you how many people know that we have a holiday called the 15th day of Av, you may have heard about the 15th day of Shvat, but I don't know how many people heard about the 15th day of Av. And yet, in the days of the Beis HaMikdash, this was one of the most joyous events. And so the Gemara wants to know, what made this particular day so joyous? And not only that, but they equate it together with what? With Yom Kippur, right? By the way, those of us who were here last Shabbos, the Shalosh Shuvos, we heard a very fine Bar Torah by Rabbi Weisfogel about this. I didn't forget. All right. At any rate, the Gemara says, Bishlamo Yom HaKippurim, we can understand why the day of Yom Kippur, which all of us, we think, by the way, we always think in terms that this is a solemn day, right? A difficult day to go through, and yet, you see, it is considered, what? A Yom Tov, a joyous day, as it says. And why? So the answer is, Mishum Diz Beis Lichum Mechila. The reason is, but this was a day upon which the Rabbeinu Shel Olam grants us forgiveness and pardon, and so we should be happy that the Rabbeinu Shel Olam loves us and he forgives our sins, right? And not only that, but as a sign of it, it's also Yom Shenitnu Bo Luchos V'Achronos. This was the day upon which, after the sin of the golden calf, and Moshe Rabbeinu prayed to God that the people should be forgiven their sins, so what did the Rabbeinu Shalom tell him to do? He told him to go up and to get a second set of luchos, And therefore, we find that the giving of the second luchos when Moshe Rabbeinu came, this was a gift to the people of Israel to indicate that God is willing to forgive our sins, and therefore this became a joyous day. But we're not finished yet with that, okay? But the Gemara says, El Tesvot Be'av, the 15th day of Av, Maihi, what is the big simcha with this particular day? So they give various reasons. Omer Rav Yehuda Omer Shmuel, so Rav Yehuda said in the name of Shmuel that Yom Shehutru Shvotim Lavoi Zebezeh. One reason why they are celebrating is because this was a day upon which the various tribes were finally given permission to intermarry with each other. My Dorosh, how did they interpret the text of the Torah? Because in the Torah we have a chapter dealing with the daughters of Tzelophehad, if you remember. The last chapter in the book of Bamidbar deals with what should happen in the case that the girls decide to get married, okay? So it says over there, Zeh Adobah Asher Tzivah Hashem Levnos Tzelophehad, that this is what the Rebbeinu Shel Olam said concerning the daughters of Tzelophehad, and the text in the Torah continues, not quoted here, but it says over there that they are permitted to marry, but only within their own tribe, only within their own shevet. They're not allowed to marry outside of that. Why? Because obviously the desire was that the property that they inherited from their father Tzelophehad should remain within the tribe itself and not go to another tribe, right? So, sages say that this was only to have effect in that particular generation. In other words, the generation of the people who were entering Eretz Yisrael after the 40 years of wandering in the wilderness. At that time, when they conquered the land, under the leadership of Joshua, so then they divided the land according to lots, and each tribe was assigned its portion, so that it would be valid for that particular generation. Omer Rav Yosef, Omer Rav Nachman, of course, but what is the implication? The implication is that subsequently, however, on the 15th day of Av, permission was given that men and women of various tribes could marry, and there was no longer restriction placed upon that. Rav Yosef, Amar Rav Yosef, Amar Rav Nachman. Rav Yosef said the name of Rav Nachman. He said, "Yom Shehuta Shevet Bin Yamin Levi Bakohol." This was a day upon which the tribe of Bin Yamin was given permission that they could marry again. Now, what were the circumstances? We read a very horrifying story towards the end of the book of Judges, Sefer Shoftim, wherein people of Bin Yamin mistreated people who had come. This is the story about the Pelegish Begibo, the concubine in the town of Gibo, and as a result of the horror that took place at that particular time, all the other tribes, they took an oath that they would not permit their daughters to marry any of the men of Binyamin. Okay? But what happened over here? So, Shadema, the verse says in the book of Judges, it says, V'ish Yisrael nishba b'mitzvah, le'mor ish b'min li'tayim b'tol v'nyomin le'isha, right? That the men of Israel took a vow in the city of Mitzvah, saying that no one of us will take as a wife a daughter, will give our daughters to people of Binyamin, that they should be their wives. My Dorish, so what? How did they interpret the text in order to do what? In order to permit once more? And this, of course, is another reason for the celebration of the 15th of Av. So Amar Rav, they said, it says bimenu, in other words, from us. But from us is below mi bonenu. This does not include our children. In other words, the subsequent generations are permitted. Okay. Rabbi Chodom or Rabbi Yochanan, he gave a different interpretation why this day was an important day. He says, Yom Shekolu Bo Meisei Midbar. This was the day upon which the generation that died in the wilderness, they stopped dying. The Omar, as one of the sages said, Ad Shalei Kolu Meisei Midbar, until the time that those who passed away in the wilderness died until it came to an end, that is, their dying. So Lo Yehu Dibur im Moshe. The Rebbeinu Shel Olam did not speak only to Moshe, but in other words, he did not speak to him with the same idea of like ponim el ponim, in other words, face to face. Shene'emar, as it's written, Vayihi kasher tamu kol anshei milchama lavus. It came to pass that when all the men of war had finally passed away, then Vayidaber Hashem Eli, so the Rebbeinu Shel Olam spoke to me, and Eli hoyu hadibur, as Rashi points out, that means that Moshe Rabbeinu is pointing out that God once more was in direct communication with him at this particular point. Okay. Not mentioned over here is the famous Gemara about the fact that every year after the Gezerah, you know, the decree had been passed that the generation that had left Egypt was to die in the wilderness during the 40 years of wandering. So when Tisha B'Av would come, they would take a look to see who was left, and people would die. And then all of a sudden, in the 40th year, there came a Tisha B'Av, right? And there was no deaths. And they thought, well, maybe it's a mistake or something like that. So they waited and waited, and then when they saw the moon full on the 15th day, they knew that this was really the end of that particular decree, and therefore they rejoiced on this day. Another reason, Ula Omar, he said that Yom Shepiter Hoshea ben Elo Prosidios Shehoshev Yerov ben Avoda Adrochem Shal Yadul Yisrael Erekel. This was the day upon which the army sentries that had been stationed originally by Yerovim ben Nevat in order to prevent people from the northern kingdom, the kingdom of Israel, from going to Yerushalayim in order to worship in the Beis HaMikdash, these were finally removed in the days of Hoshea ben Elo, who was the last king of Israel. He removed them so that once more it was possible for people in every tribe of Israel, north or south, to go to Yerushalayim and to observe in the Beis HaMikdash. The Yomar, the Yomar, and he said, in other words, Hoshea ben Elo said, wherever they want to go, they can go. If they want to stay in the kingdom of Israel, okay, but if they want to go to Yerushalayim, they no longer have to be prevented by the sentries. The sentries would let them go past. Rab Master Omar, he gave a different interpretation. He says, Yom Shinitu Haruge Beit HaLikvura, says this was the day when those who were slain in Beitar by the Romans were finally given permission to be buried. And this is a reference to the time of Bar Kokhba, the war when Israel again, the Jews in Eretz Israel, rose up against the Romans, and for 3 years they fought against the entire Roman Empire in order to try to regain their freedom. And eventually Beitar, which was the final stronghold of the Jewish people, fell, and the Romans did not permit burial to take place. So finally, on the 15th day of Av, permission was given to bury them. The Yom Rab Masna said, Osa Yom Shenitnu Haruge Beitar Legvura, that day upon which those who were slain in Beitar were finally permitted to be buried, Tiknu B'Yavne, at that time in the yeshiva in Yavne, where of course Rabbi Yochanan ben Zakkai and his descendants were, that they decided at that particular point to say the Brocha HaTov HaMeitiv. This is the Brocha, of course, that we say in the benching, you know, HaTov HaMeitiv LaKol, and so on. Okay, Hatov, God is good, Shelo Hisrichu, because the bodies of the dead did not putrefy. The Hametiv, and God does good unto us, She Nitnu Legvura, that they were finally able to be buried. Rab Yosef, Abin Tavaihu, Rabba and Rab Yosef said, both of them, that there's another significance. It's Yom Shepasku Melechros Eitzim L'Ma'arocha. This was the day upon which they stopped cutting firewood to place on the altar. Ketanya, Rabbi Eliezer Godel Omer, that Mechamisha also be'or be'elech toshes kocha shel chaba. Rabbi Eliezer taught that beginning with the 15th day of Av, the sun loses some of its intensity. Below hayu korsin eitzim marochen, therefore, beginning with this particular day, they would no longer cut new wood for the altar, because the fish ain't on yevashim, because they would not have a chance to dry properly. If they were moist, they would attract worms, and of course, on the altar, wood cannot be used which contain any worms. So therefore, it was a festival. And Omar Rabbi Nashia, he said, the Korulei, and they gave it a nickname this particular day. They called it Yom Tabor Magal. This was the day upon which the axe was broken. In other words, there was no need anymore for an axe in order to chop down the trees. The Kamba Eilach, and beginning then with the 15th day of Av, from this time on, he says, the Mosef Yosef, the law Mosef Yosef, or Ye Yosef. The more that you learn, the better it is, and if you don't learn, then eventually it will not be a good ending. Because Maya Yosef, what is the meaning of that? Says Amarav Yosef, Tikbarei Ime, which means that he will die prematurely because of the fact what? Maybe he may not die, let's say, physically, but if a person doesn't learn, he will certainly die spiritually. And the fact that the evenings get longer, beginning with the 15th day of Og, right? There's more evening hours, means that after working hard all day, you have that much more time at night in order to learn. So that, therefore, when we have our night sessions, hopefully we carry out some of this teaching. All right? And then the concluding Mishnah deals about the fact that what did they do in order to celebrate both Yom Kippur and the 15th day above? And the answer is that the maidens of Yerushalayim would go out into the vineyards and they would dance. And of course, the young men would go to look at them and to admire them, right? So, Tana Rabbanan, our sages taught, says, Bas Melech, Shoels Bas Kohen Godol. Okay, I left out something in the Mishnah to explain right now. The fact is that not only did they go out to dance in the vineyards, but none of the girls wore their own clothing. Instead, what did they do? They borrowed clothes from each other. Why? The basic reason being, in order not to embarrass a girl who didn't have enough money for a wardrobe. So since everybody borrowed clothing, therefore they could get finery from somebody else, you see. Alright? So the Gemara continues and says that Bas Melech, for example, the daughter of the king, Shoetz for Bas Kohen Godel. She would borrow clothing from the daughter of the Kohen Godel. Bas Kohen Godel, the daughter of the Kohen Godel, where should she borrow from? She can't borrow from the king's daughter, so it's not fitting, but she had somebody a little bit lower in the pecking order, okay? So she would get it with Bas Zagat. She would get it from the deputy Kohen, okay? The deputy for the high priest. But Bas Zagat, and the daughter of this deputy of the high priest, would get it with Bas Moshoach Milchoma. She would get it from the priest who was chosen to be like the chief army chaplain, okay? Bas Moshoach Milchoma, and the daughter of the Mashiach Milchoma, you know, this army chaplain, the head army chaplain, she would get it in Bas Kohen Hedyot. She would get it from any ordinary Kohen, from the daughter of an ordinary Kohen. The Chol Yisrael Sholim Zemizeh, and all Israel would borrow clothing from each other, Kedei Shalo Yisbayish Es Mishaino, in order that the one who did not have any would not be embarrassed. And because of the fact they're all borrowed, so the Mishnah adds, and then the Gemara adds, that Kol HaKelim Tunin Tevila, that all these garments had to be immersed in the mikveh to make sure that they were free from any form of tumah. Omer Rabbi Elazar, and Rabbi Elazar, he says, Apil mekupolim enochim mekufsa, even clothing that had been folded away and lying in a box in the storage, right, even they had to be also titled in the mikvah. Then it says, "Benos Yisrael yotzes becholus bakramim." The daughters of Israel would go out and they would dance in the vineyards. And Tana, and we have a tradition that says, "Mishen lo yisho niflu l'shem." Whoever is unmarried, whichever unmarried man there is, he would turn over there in order to see, you know, to find out who would be a suitable candidate for marriage, right? So miyuchosu shebahen hoyu omros bochur and so on. Those who were who had a lot of yichas, they would say, and we'll see. They would, of course, the Gemara now expands upon this, and it says, Tana Rabbanan, our sages taught that Yefeifiyo Shebohen, the girls among them who were beautiful, Mahay Omros, what did they say? They would say, Tenue Nechem Layofi. Look at beauty. She'en Hu Isha Layofi, because woman was created to be beautiful. Okay? Very nice. Every woman is beautiful, right? Miyuchasu Shebohen, and those who came from fine families, Mahay Omros, what would they say? They would say, Tenue Nechem Mishpocha. Look at the kind of mishpacha that we come from. Lefi shein ha'isha l'bonim, because a woman, her function is to have children, and therefore, if you come from a good family, hopefully, you know, your children in turn will also be, you know, proud descendants of such families. Nechoaros shebahen. What about the girls who are a little bit on the homely side? Mehoyomros. What did they have to say? So they would say, Kechu mikachachem l'shum shemayim. Says they would say to the eligible young man, he says, look, you'll have a great mitzvah. Rabbeinu Shalom will be very happy if you go and you do this kind of business with us. In other words, make a shidduch with us, right? As long as you give us geld. The geld, of course, would be for Nadan, naturally. I mean, right. They have to buy a trousseau and everything else. So even they, not only did they not despair, but they also had a good argument to sell to the young men. Omar Ula Bira, so Ula Bira said, Omar Rabbi Elazar, he said, since we're talking about dances, so he says, the Rebbeinu Shalom one day is going to make a dance for all the righteous people. He will be sitting in their midst in Gan Eden. And every person who will be zeicher, as we would say, who will have this privilege of being in Gan Eden, will be able to point to the Rebbeinu Shel Olam Shenemar and say to him, "The Omar Bayom Hahu." And on that day, they will say, "Hinei Eloheinu Zekivinu Lo Veyishayenu." This is God in whom we have always hoped, and He will save us. Zarenoi Kivinu Lo. This is God in whom we have hoped. Let us rejoice and be happy in His salvation. Now I need another Gemara in order to say the Padron over here. Hopefully it's in here.
Yeah.
Good, very good. Okay. All right, we can stand up at this point. Padron alot maseches tanis vadon alon vahadroch alon daton alot maseches tanis vadroch alon l'stashi binot maseches tanis v'nestashi minon lo b'al modim lo b'al modim. We hope that we will one day again study this. We should be zeicher because it's a privilege to study the Talmud again and again. And you know, as it says, you cannot compare studying something me'ach hayamim to me'ach v'yachat, right? To studying it 101 times. 100 is a good thing, but 101 is even better, right? Yiratzol mifanecha adnoy lehim nesenu shet tovatzcho b'motzenu b'olam hazeh seyim honu le'olam habo. Chanina bar Papa, Rabbi bar Papa, Nachman bar Papa, Achad ben Papa, Abar, Mori bar Papa, Raphim bar Papa, Rachish bar Papa, Sulcha bar Papa, Adar bar Papa, Dor bar Papa. Hareb no Adonai Lehinu is the base of Sabatino, Fios Amcha Bezisrael, Edea Nachman Sereinu, it's a Tzoy Amcha Bezisrael, Kolom Yer Shemech, Olam Yishuvasecha, Lishmo, Meyo Yevait Chak Meinim Mitzvasecha, Yom Hili, Yehili Vissamim Kokech, Laman Oibosh, Yom Hashkach, Pikudecha, Kibam Chi Yisoni, Baruch ato Adonai Lamdeinu Chukecho, Amen, 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 Selavoel. Modem anachtu mponech anoi lehim enseinu she samtachol kenim miyoshe beis ha-midrash velo samtachol kenim miyoshe kronos she'onu mashkimim lehim mashkimim onu mashkimim du livei toyer lehim mashkimim du borim betele onu amelim lehim amelim onu amelim mekabim socho vehim amelim vehim mekabim socho onu rotsim lehim rotsim onu rotsim lechayu el mahabo vehim rotsim lebel shachas shenema yator lehim toredim leshachas anshir limimu deyaskid mehem vani eftach boch. Want to amend it now from the singular to the plural. Okay, it's a chutz kol apanim amoyim esalmid echachom yamod lanu zareinu shelo tabush atom epi nu. V'sizkayim bono b'hishalechecho tam chaveshach b'shafecho teshmorlech v'hakitzos yisrichecho yivigim bul yomlech v'zosif v'lecho eshtos chayim v'rachim nimino b'spirosh v'chavod adonai oz v'yamo yitein v'nibrech sablo v'shalom Yizkadal v'yizkadah shenei rabo v'yomo nivro v'hu asir l'yizkadato v'lachayot n'yisayel l'asok al yasun l'chayel mo v'nibnei kato d'yirushleim v'shachlolo ha'yichalim v'gavei ומעקה פולחון ונוחו בן אבו ולעשו בפולחון ונשמייל יעשרי ים לקודש ברוך ובאלחוץ ובקורי בחייכם ובימיכם וחיידכו בישראל בעגול ובזמן קרים וימרו עמי יהי שמי רבו מברך נגלם ובונה ומאיו יזברך וישתבח ויספולה וישרימה ויסנצי ויסעדל ויסעלה ויסעלל שני לקודשו בריחו לאלו ממקור ביחסה ושירסה דויש בחסה ונחמסה דם ירום ביולמו ואימרו אמן על ישראל ויעל רבנון ויעל תלמידי הום ויעל כל תלמידי תלמידי הום ויעל כל מן ויוסקים לרעיסו דיבי עצרו הדי ודיבי כל עשר ועשר יהי להול נלחם שלמה רבו תינו וחיסטו ורחמין וחיין עריכין ומזוני רביכי וחוקנו מן קודם עבור נבשמי ויערו ונימו אמן יהי שלמה רבו משמיו וחיים טובים ועולינו ויעלכו ישראל וימרו אמן עושה שלום במימוד וברחמו ויעשה שלום עולינו ויעלכו ישראל וימרו אמן Thank you, thank you very much. Dinner is being served in the main dining room.
I see the light. Very good. Okay, if you remember way back in when we were studying brachas together at that time, we learned a special prayer that Rabbi Nachum Anakanda would say before he would begin learning and after he would learn. And so I think it's appropriate to begin in the same spirit and to say that as we're about to begin the study of Makos, my prayer to God is that we should give a good interpretation of our text so that we shouldn't cause any stumbling blocks, and may God help us that we should be able to learn this Masechta as sweetly and as wonderfully as we've done the previous Masechtas that we've completed. Having said that, I have to add also that the material over here I think in general is going to be a little bit more difficult than what we had whether it was in Brachos or in Tanis. Because here we're dealing with certain subjects of Jewish law that at times it seems that the theory is a little bit difficult for us to understand. We'll see in a few minutes what I mean by that. And of course we also will have, a miscellany of different things, as in every Masechta. I mean, we know that when they start with a text, but they're going to begin proofs in two or three or four or five different places, and each one requires its own analysis, okay? So let me say, first of all, a word in general about Maseches Makos. It happens to be a little bit shorter than some of the other Masechtas that we've learned. Altogether, 24 dapim, okay? Mm-hmm. But the fact that it's shorter doesn't mean that it's necessarily any easier for us. However, it gives us a goal, and I think that within a year we should be able to do it without any great difficulty, okay? There are only three chapters of Makos. The first one, as you see, deals with the subject of what we call Edom Zomimim. We'll discuss that in a second. The second one deals with who merits the punishment of what we call Golus. In other words, that they have to go into exile as a punishment for the sin that they have committed, and we'll go over that specifically on what does the Torah have to say in that connection. And then the last chapter deals with Elohein Halokin, in other words, what are the various rules concerning people who are subject to the penalty of Makos, and how is it administered, and for what particular crimes is it a punishment, and so on. But of course, we'll be running back and forth as we go in the Masechta, because they're going to quote in order to analyze or to contradict whatever it may be, something that will be found a little further on. And, we sort of have to explain it in its proper place, okay, so that we'll understand the subject matter that we're dealing with over here.
How do you spell your name? Irving?
Sir, S-E-R.
Irving, S-E-R.
Wait for the
title. Yeah. Okay.
You can go right into the doubling.
Right. One other thing, and that is that we have in learning Talmud sometimes the expression drosh v'kabel spar, which means study, learn, and receive the reward for the learning, even though practically it may not have a practical application today. We are, of course, dealing with a period when Makos, or Malkos, as other people call it, was a punishment that could be inflicted by the Beis Din. Of course, the English translation for that would be flogging, okay? Mm-hmm. And as we saw, it's not dead in certain parts of the world. I mean, the recent Singapore episode, for example, reminds mm-hmm. us that a form of Malkos is still practiced over there, right? Mm-hmm. And some argue that maybe this would be a fit punishment for some transgressors today as well, even in our own society. We have Walter present this evening, and I think that all of us know that Walter has been active all these years in the ACLU, and I'm sure that he has very strong opinions about some of the penalties that we'll be reading about this evening, okay, or in future days. All right, the Mishnah begins with the following question, okay, we're on Beis. All right. The Mishnah begins by saying, "Ketzad ho'edim na'asim zomimin." Under what conditions can witnesses become edim zomimin? Okay. So, of course, the first thing we have to define: what do we mean by an ed zomim? Okay. First of all, it says edim. Why does it say edim? Because we know that there's a rule in the Torah which says that you must have a minimum of two witnesses. Al pishnayim edim yokum dover, right? That requires at least two witnesses. But what happens if you have three witnesses or 100 witnesses or what may be? The answer is that their edus has to always be in conformity one with another. And should anything go wrong, then even if, let's say, one has the right opinion and the other has the wrong opinion, but nevertheless, you have to look at it as one body. Okay? All right. Now, what is the law about Zomimin, specifically? I just mentioned, the law about Eidos, about witnesses, okay? So, presumably, we have two witnesses. Now, the Torah says that if two witnesses come and they testify in a case, okay? And, of course, the judges are prepared, to judge on the basis of what the witnesses have said. Along come two other witnesses, and they say, "Hey, how can you guys testify in this particular case?" Mikey, you'll have to look on. I was looking for another Gemara over here, and I didn't see it. Next week, Mirz Hashem, I'll bring my own from the house, so we'll have some extra around up here, okay? Yeah. But this is oral Torah anyway. Yeah. Okay. So along comes a second set of witnesses. And specifically, what do these witnesses say? They're not testifying about the trial itself. Because if they were to testify about the trial, then they would not be Edim Zomimin. They would be maybe Edim Machichishim. We have a difference of opinion, where two sets of witnesses contradict each other on what they actually saw. Then in that particular case, it's very difficult for a Beis Din to draw any conclusion, because how would we say, that one set of witnesses is any better than the other? Okay? So that's Edim Machichishim, says there, okay? It sort of reminds you of what we say at the end of Rabbi Yishmael, except that there we're saying V'chein Shnei Ksuvim HaMachichishim, says there. When you have two verses in the Torah that seem to contradict each other, so then we have to look for a third verse which will solve the problem, you see. Acha Yovei HaKosev HaShlishav Yachnei HaBinayim, and then we can judge, what it is. So those are Edim Machichishim. They're not Edim Zomimin. Specifically, Edim Zomimin come and they say to to the first set of witnesses. They say, how can you testify about the time, the place, and so on, that you saw an event take place when, at that particular moment, imonu hayisem, you were with us. In other words, you were with us in a different place at that very same time. So, in that particular case, what does the Torah say? The Torah says that va'asisem lo kasher zoma'am la'asos liyochid. You have to do unto him, meaning this unto the witnesses, you know, these, the first set of witnesses, you have to do unto them what they had planned to do to the person, you know, who was being tried. Okay? So the punishment that would have been given to that person instead has to be incurred by, the witnesses who came and testified against him. So in other words, they're not testifying to the event, but they are testifying to the fact that at the time and the place that the witnesses claimed to have seen it, they weren't there.
They're not reliable.
They were not reliable. Not only are they not reliable, but they were actually in the presence of this new set of witnesses, the Edom Zomimim, who say, you know, who come to say that the other guys are Edom Zomimim. Mm-hmm. In other words, that they are not only false witnesses, but you know, they're doing it deliberately in order to make the person who is being tried incurred whatever penalty it may be, and therefore they deserve to get the same penalty that would have been meted out to him. Okay? This is the basic idea behind it.
The secondary witnesses are not a fourth one.
That's a good question. But the answer is that we feel that the second group are testifying not about the event that they, because they don't claim that they have seen the event. What they claim is that the witnesses themselves cannot be reliable witnesses because of the fact that they were with them. And now, if they can prove, you know, that they were, then in that particular case, that throws out the case against, what the first witnesses said, so that those first witnesses now become what we call Edom Zomimim, from the word Zomam. In other words, they had intended, you know, that the person who against whom they are testifying, you know, should incur whatever particular penalty is concerned. Okay? Now, what are they testifying to? That is, what do the original people testify to? The answer is, there could be various things. It could be a crime that involved capital punishment, or it could be a crime that involves monetary punishment. And so, theoretically, whatever the punishment would have been given, you know, to the person who was accused, should be the punishment inflicted upon them. Yeah, this is, I say, theoretically. Yes.
Yeah, but it could be witnesses also to testify to the innocence of the party involved.
Okay.
So how can you?
Good. If other witnesses come, then, as I say, these already would be machechishim. In other words, Reuben and Shimon are saying, look, I saw that this and this happened. Okay? Levi and Yehuda come along and they say, look, I saw the same event, and it's not the way you described it, but it's the way, you know, we saw it. So in that particular case, the judge doesn't know which way to make a determination. And, then the case would probably have to be deferred, or punishment would have to be deferred, or whatever it may be. But obviously, let's say if it were a capital case, nobody could be convicted on that basis. You understand?
But how do they determine the reliability of a witness in the first place?
Okay. The Gemara in Sanhedrin has a very painstaking analysis of what do they do to the witnesses. The third chapter in Sanhedrin deals specifically, towards the end of the chapter, with, a case that Botkin is her Edom, okay? And then after that, it continues to several other chapters as well. That they have to ask the witnesses specific questions. Where did you see it? Under what circumstances? what time was it, where was it, what could you testify as to, let's say, any circumstantial conditions, you know, what was taking place over there and so on. For example, they quote a famous story about Yochanan ben Zakkai, that he asked the witnesses, please describe to me what kind of leaves were on the fig trees, the te'enim, okay? And it says over there, the uktze te'enim, in other words, like the points. He wanted to know specifically, what did the points look like, or something like that? Did they have, what did they look like, and things like that. So, not only that, but the very first thing that they are told before they do anything else, it says over there, case of the ayamim, eso edim. Now, what do you mean by ayam? If you know Hebrew, you know that ayam means to threaten. In other words, they threaten the witnesses that, God forbid, if they should, you know, give false testimony, then they could, chas v'shalom, endanger the life of a person. Of course, we're talking about where a capital case is concerned, but even the monetary cases. Because, as the Gemara says in Sanhedrin, it says, echad dinei mamonos, echad dinei nefoshes, makes no difference whether we are dealing with monetary cases or with capital cases. Bidrisha v'chakira. In other words, with a very careful examination of the witnesses. So that way, you see, they're trying to determine the reliability of the witnesses. Of course, it's always possible, you know, that you'll have false witnesses. Mm. A famous story, for example, about Jezebel. Remember the story about Jezebel and the vineyard of Naboth, Kerem Novos, where King Ahab desired the vineyard that was owned by Novos, and he came to Novos and he said to him, the vineyard happened to be next to the palace grounds, okay? So he said to him, he says, look, sell me this field because I would like to have it, or if you wish, I'll give you an even better field someplace else. But, you know, I would like to have this field. Now, normally a person doesn't go around defying the king, you know, but Novos was a stubborn character. He said, look, my father's owned this field, my grandfather owned this field, the father, you know, his father owned this field, and I'm not going to give up something that has been kept in the family for all these generations. So as a result, King Ahab was greatly depressed because he couldn't convince Novos to sell him the vineyard. And his queen, Jezebel, or Rezebel, we call her in Hebrew, she saw, that her husband he felt very, very melancholy, very bad. And she said, what happened? So he told her the story. So she said to him, you're a king. I'll show you what a king should do. And you'll get this vineyard, okay? And so therefore, what did she do? She wrote to the elders of the village where Novos was living, and she said to them, get me a couple of shady characters. In Hebrew, it's B'nei Belial. In other words, you know, real wicked people, right? Gangsters, whatever you want to call them, okay? And they should testify that they heard Novos curse God and King. Because for that, the penalty was death. And not only was the penalty death, but the penalty would be what? Expropriation of the property,
confiscation.
Right, confiscation, expropriation. So as a result, they summoned the Novos before the elders of the town, you know, the judges and so on, and in the presence of the judges, these two guys came and testified that they heard Novos curse God and King, and of course, what was the punishment? The punishment was death by stoning. So Novos was killed, and as a result, you know, so Ahab inherited the field. And then, of course, along came Eliyahu HaNavi in order to give him a good scolding and threatening him, you know, that his punishment in the end would be that he would die in battle and the dogs would lick his blood, even as dogs had licked the blood of the Novos, you know, after he was dead. But from this we see that, of course, it is possible at times that, you know, witnesses will give false testimony. But as much as possible, The sages tried to prevent it by very, very careful questioning of the people who came forth as witnesses. Okay? Like any system, it may work most of the time, but you know, there are times when it just didn't work.
I'm just curious, did they swear witnesses in at that time? Like we do today?
If necessary.
They did swear them
in. If necessary, sure. We have various cases, you know, that require the taking of an oath. Okay? Now, whether specifically in this case, you know, they required that, but we know from the Torah itself, we have the laws that we call the Arba Shomim. In other words, four people who serve as guardians. Okay? You have a Shema Sochar, a Shema Chinam, right? You have a Shoel and a Socher. Those are the four categories. So, in some of these categories, as for example, the Shema Chinam, generally speaking, in other words, he's doing you a favor by keeping an eye on whatever you entrusted to him, right? So he's doing you a favor. It's a mitzvah, okay? Now, what happens if, let's say, the thing that you entrusted to him is stolen by somebody else, right? Or is lost? Then in that particular case, he has to take an oath in order to be freed from the penalty of having to make good, you know, what was entrusted to him. He has a responsibility. And if he doesn't take the oath, then he must make it up out of his own pocket. Mm-hmm. Okay? So there specifically an oath is required. And there are some other cases too where oaths have to be taken. Okay? Here, because we're in a world now where we have to understand, you know, the meaning of the various terms that we have and try to put ourselves in the place of our Chachamim in the text. All right. So, here come two witnesses, and they say that, you know, hey, you first guys, how could you be testifying, you know, when you were with us in this place or this in this time? And therefore, the first set of witnesses become Edom Zomimim, right? They are Zomimim. So, the question is
Zomimim.
Zomim. The verse in the Torah says, "La'atzisem lo, you should do unto him, kasher zomam la'atzos liyochid," even as he, you know, tried to do to his brother. Okay? So, on this basis, it's called Zomim, okay? All right, now. Yes, probably it does. It's a word, you know, for lewd action or something like that. Okay? Yeah.
What is the word?
Huh?
What is the word?
Zimor.
Zimor.
Right. We read it in Parsha, you know, Achrei Mos, you know, where we had the business with the Arroyos and things like that. Okay? So, all right. Now, the first case that the Mishnah is now going to mention is a case where we cannot carry out the actual punishment that should be given to Edom Zomimim. What is this first case that they mention? So, it says, "Me'idinonu b'yish pleni." We are testifying against this guy. In other words, we're talking now of the testimony of the first group of witnesses. Okay? So, we testify about so-and-so, Shehu ben Grusho ben Chalutza, okay? That he is either the son of a divorced woman or the son of a woman who had received Chalitza. Now, naturally, what kind of a person are we talking about? Talking about a Kohen, because only in the Kohen does it make a difference if he is the son of a woman who was divorced or who was, you know, given chalitza. Okay, remember what chalitza is?
Yes.
Right. In other words, the man died, he had a brother, and the brother came before, well, yeah, either he married her,
or
else he gave her, you know, chalitza. If he married her, that's not called chalitza, that's called yibum.
He rejected it.
That's yibum, right. But chalitza means, you know, that he takes off his shoe, the present of the right, and he says, you know, I don't want to take this woman, and so on, and then she has to spit before him, and so on, and say, you know, this shall be done to a person who does not want to, you know, to raise up the name of his brother in Israel, right? So, the law is, of course, we're reading it in the Torah this week,
Parsha Emor, that what? A Kohen is not allowed to marry what? A woman who is a zona, in other words, who has been involved in lewdness, right? Or the chalolo. Who is the chalolo? We'll say that in a second. The yeshua grusha me isha, nor a woman who has been divorced from her husband. Okay. Now, what is the chalolo? The chalol specifically is the descendant of, you know, let's say the union of a Kohen with such a type of a woman. Then the child, the son becomes a cholol, okay? But once he's a cholol, then it's possible to pass down this business of being a cholol, you know, to any future children. So in other words, these people came along and they said that how could this guy, that is, how could this young man, okay, be considered a full-fledged Kohen? He is a cholol. Why is he a cholol? Because his mother, when she married the Kohen, was either a divorced woman, okay? We're not discussing whether, you know, the mother was a woman with an evil reputation. That's already in the case of the Zona, you know.
Right.
The priest is not supposed to marry such a type of a woman. And there are two other things that by rabbinic law a Kohen is not allowed to marry. What are they? One is mentioned over here, namely a woman who has received chalitza from her first husband's brother. She's not allowed to marry a Kohen because it's considered a certain blemish in the yichus. I mean, this is what it boils down to. And there's one other that we learned. We learned all this in Kedushin, by the way.
The Kohen Gadol,
in addition, it can only marry only a virgin. It's not allowed to marry even an almona. Yeah.
Right.
But we learned, now I'm talking about a Kohen Hedya, the ordinary Kohen. It's one more case. Anybody think of it?
Daughter of a convert.
Right, a convert. He can't marry a woman who's a convert. Right. So, in other words, if the Kohen married a convert, then automatically, you know, the child, the son would be a cholol. Okay?
Right.
All right. So, these witnesses who have come in order to testify, they say that this guy is the offspring of a Kohen who was, you know, as I say, he married either a cholol or a gerusha or a chalutza and so on and so forth.
Right.
Okay. That being the case, the question is, what can you do with these witnesses? You know, when the second set of witnesses come along and say, these guys are a bunch of liars, because when they say they saw that he married the divorced woman, let's say, they weren't there at the wedding ceremony. Where were they? They were with us, right? So they could not be testifying to the truth of what they saw. Okay? So, what should be the punishment of the witnesses who came forth and said that he was a ben grusho, a ben chalutzo? Understand? Can we say that, okay? Ein omrim, then we cannot say, and continue with the Mishnah, what? Yeyos azeh ben grusho ben chalutzo tachtov? That, okay, since what they wanted to do is to declare that he is the son of a grusho or chalutza, right? In other words, they declare him a cholol. Therefore, they in turn should be declared cholol. Is this the punishment that you want to mete out to them? No. First of all, even if they're kehanim, the question is whether you have the power, you see, to passel them as kehanim on that basis. That's number one. And secondly, maybe they're not even kehanim. So the whole thing would not apply to them. Still, they deserve a punishment for coming and spreading a false story about the Kohen. So what is the punishment? Elo lo ka'aboyim. But instead, what is his punishment? His punishment is that he's going to have 40 malchus. Now, what is 40 malchus? It means that he literally should get 40 blows. However, as we'll learn later on, this would be in the third chapter, you know, in Elein Halokin, where they deal specifically with the punishment of Malkos. So there we learn that, number one, they interpret the Torah where it says about Malkos, right, that he's to be given 40 blows and you're not allowed to add to it. And then it says, because Pen Yosef La Koisoi, that if you give him more, then V'niklo Achicho B'Einecha, your brother will become cheapened, literally, in your eyes. In other words, he'll be disgraced in your eyes. So from this, we're going to learn that, number one, even after he gets the Malkus, he should still be considered what? Ochicho, you still have to consider him as a brother. And secondly, because of the disgrace that's already involved, you can't even give him 40. Instead, what do you give him?
39.
You give him 39, right. Okay? So it became an expression, you know, like Arboim Chosirachas. Okay? 40 minus 1. Okay? Subsequently, we're going to learn that they want, anyway, that the Malkos that they give have to be divided by 3. The number has to be divided by 3. Alright. Obviously, 40 cannot be divided by 3, but 39 can very nicely be. But who says that he has to get all 39? The answer is, it depends completely upon his physical condition. If a doctor says that he's not capable of getting, you know, of being able to stand, because after all, he still has to emerge, as we said, Ochicho, he still has to be your brother when it's all finished and he suffered his punishment, right? So in that case, if the doctor says, for example, you know, that this man can only take, let's say, 15 blows, then that's it. Or he can only take 9 blows, then that's it. Or 6 blows, whatever it may be, understand? But it has to be a number divisible by 3.
Why?
I'll tell you why. Because they gave him twice in the back and once in the front, or something like that. But we'll come to it when we get to it. Okay? So it has to be a number divisible by 3. That's the reason why. But, as you know, as I said, it's dependent upon his physical condition, and you know, you cannot generalize about that. I mean, of course, we still have to have regard for the human personality. All right. So he suffers Malkus if he makes this, because you cannot apply that. All right. Next part of the Mishnah, eaten on the Bishplani, Shulchayev Liglos. If, you know, these first set of witnesses, they come and they say, we testify against so-and-so that he committed a crime for which exile is the punishment. All right, where in the Torah do we find that exile is a punishment?
Accidental death.
Exactly. That's where we find it. Okay? You have it. Yeah. You have it in various places. Actually, there are two places, particularly in the Torah, where you have it. Place number one would be in, you know, Matas Masai. You have a mention over there. And then you have another mention made, again, towards the end of Parsha Shoftim, where they deal with the problem, you know, how do we distinguish between accidental death and premeditated death? That is, premeditated murder and then accidental murder. And we'll go into that in greater detail when we come into the second chapter, because it depends, again, what is the nature of the accidental death? Was it caused by negligence, or was it something that could not be foreseen at all? It's, you know, it's sort of like what people sometimes refer to as an act of God, you know. That's not the expression that the Chazal use, okay? But at any rate, in the case of having killed somebody, what we would call today, let's say, manslaughter or something like that, although God knows the way the legal system is built up today, where you have first degree, second degree, third degree, I don't know the difference anymore between one and another. But in the Torah, it's clear. Right. But in the Torah, it's clear. I mean, that you had no premeditation. As the Torah says, "V'hu lo oyev lo," right? He was not an enemy of this person. "V'lo mevakesh ro so," and he did not seek to do harm to this person. Okay? So in that case, when, and of course, it has to be determined by whom? By the Beis Din. The Beis Din has to judge it. And if the Beis Din, you know, judges that he really did not have any premeditation, so in that case, what does he have to do? He has to go to into exile. And where does he go into exile? So, of course, we learned, you know, that there were 6 cities of refuge, 3 east of the Jordan and 3 west of the Jordan.
that were set up. Okay? Parsha Vezchanan.
Three more that were added.
Then also question about Levitical cities as well. Okay? As to whether they might serve, you know, as a temporary exile. But the others were places of more permanent exile, and how long it was to be over there, we'll learn afterwards, you know, in the second chapter, where we deal with the business of Golas, that it was during the lifetime of the Kohen Gadol. And when the Kohen Gadol dies, then he can leave the city of exile, or the city of refuge, as they call it, Yer Miklot, right, or in Miklot, and return to his home. And what would happen if he stepped out of the Yer HaNiklot prior to the time when his release came?
He could be killed.
Rotation. He could be killed by whom?
By the Rotation. Family.
Rotation. Right. The Adam, exactly. In other words, a family member of the person who was killed had a right, you know, to exact punishment for him. Okay? So this is what the Torah has to say, and of course I don't have to tell you that it's going to be hedged and circumscribed and so on and so forth, you know, by our sages, you know, when they get around to it in the chapter that we'll be studying. Okay, so let's say they say concerning this man that he deserves to go into exile. So we say, "Ein omrim yigla zetachtov." I mean, this would have made sense, right? That we say, all right, look, these zomimim, these guys, you know, who testified falsely against him, let them go into exile, right? No, that's not their punishment. Why not? This we'll study as we go along with the text over here, all right? Elo lo ke'aboyim, but instead he's going to suffer 40 lashes as his penalty. And as I said, you know, 40 lashes means 39, technically, okay? All right. All right. Now, we continue. Gemara wants to say, Ho Ketzad. The Gemara is puzzled, first of all, about the language itself. Mishnah says, Ketzad. How are the witnesses, how did they become Zomimin, right? Literally, that's the translation of the first four words in the Mishnah. And then they give a case, you know, about, you know, that they testify, for example, about so-and-so, that he's the son of the Chalola, Grusha, Chalutza, etc., etc., right? So, Gemara notes over here, it says, okay, Sadhawa, why does the Mishnah use that language? It should say, rather, Ein ho edim nasim zomimim miboyle. It should say instead, Ketzad, how is it that witnesses do not get the penalty of zomimim, even though they are zomimim? That's the way it is, because in both cases that we have in the Mishnah over here, they're not getting the penalty that they wanted to inflict upon the person against whom they testified, right? But instead, they have a different penalty given out to them. So this should be the wording of the Mishnah. V'yod, and furthermore, midikatoni lekama, since a little further on we're going to be learning that Omru lahem heichatem yidim, that, you know, the second group of witnesses come along and they say to the first group, how can you testify? Shaharei b'yosa hayom atem heyisim imonim imokim pleni, right? On that day that you claim that you saw this and this event take place, you were with us in this and this place, right? So harei elu zomimin. Then these are zomimin, right? So then that gives a definition that these are edim zomimin. So he says, Tana, I'm skipping a little bit. Well, all right, the parenthesis would say, Miklal de Elo Ein Zomimin. Miklal means, therefore, this excludes what? That the Elo, in other words, these two people that they're talking about, you know, those who testified against the Kohen, or those who testified that the person deserves Golos as his punishment, right? So they're not considered Zomimin, or they don't get the punishment of Zomimin, right? All right, so the Gemara continues and says, Tana Hosam Kai. Actually, our Mishnah is based upon something that we had over there. Where was over there? The answer is in Gemara Sanhedrin. As I mentioned this evening at the beginning, to a certain extent, this is a continuation of the Gemara Sanhedrin. In Sanhedrin, if you remember, I mentioned already some of the material that is dealt with as far as who qualifies as judges, who can qualify as witnesses, all right? And then, towards the end of Sanhedrin, they discuss four different types of capital punishment. We say it every Yom Kippur, if you remember, Skila, Sreifa, Herik, Vechenik. In other words, there are four different methods of punishing. Skila means that the person is stoned to death, right? Sreifa means that they put hot molten lead in his mouth and he burned them that way, right? Skila, Sreifa. Herik means that they use a sword and chop off his head. This was the Roman method of punishment, okay? And finally, Chenik, that's a nice easy one. All they have to do is to strangle him to death, okay? And so the Gemara in the Sanhedrin, you know, mentions these different punishments and it goes into details how they could be carried out, okay? Later on, we're going to learn over here in the Gemara that if a Sanhedrin actually condemned a person to death, they were looked upon as being a bunch of murderers. Walter likes that Mishnah, I know. But, I mean, as I said before, you know, it's in the category also of Drosh V'Kabel Tzchar. We have to learn, and we get reward for the learning of these things, even though they're a little bit far from us, you know, under our present circumstances today. But still, everything that we learn in the field of Torah is worthwhile for its own sake, too. There's an intrinsic value in the study of Torah, which, you know, does not necessarily have to lead to a practical consequence. We get a reward for learning even theoretical material of this type, okay? So, after those chapters that deal with different types of capital punishment, so then the logical thing that would have followed would be what? This mission in Makkos, okay? In other words, and where you cannot give capital punishment, then in that case, what is an alternative method of punishment, right? And so we determined that the alternative method of punishment would be, in this particular case, Malchus. Okay, so that's what he's saying over there. He says, Tano Hosum Kai. He's referring over there where we learned that Kol Azomimim Magdinim Le'osam Iso. In the Gemara in Sanhedrin, it says over there that whoever is found guilty of being an aid zome, right? In other words, he gave false witness in a capital punishment case, then in that case, he is given that same punishment. Chutz mizomame bas koenu vo'alon, with an exception of those who have testified falsely about a daughter of a Kohen who happened to be, of course, a married woman, not talking about a Penuya, okay, but who happened to be a married woman, and she had relations, you know, with a person other than her husband. In other words, she committed adultery with him. And in that case, She'ein Magdim L'Yosem Miso, they do not get the identical punishment, as we see, Elo L'Misa Acheres, but rather they have a different punishment than the one which theoretically should be given. Why? Because in the case of the Bas Kohen, it says specifically, Bas Ish Kohen Ki Secher Lisnos, we're going to read it in the Torah this week, right? That the daughter of a Kohen who profanes herself by becoming a Zoyna, in other words, by having, extramarital affairs and so on, right? Then Esovio Himechalelis, she brings disgrace upon her own father, and Boesh Tisarefa, and her punishment therefore is Srefa. Whereas the Boel, the person with whom she had, her lover, so to speak, right, he gets a different punishment. He also gets, right, yeah, but his happens to be Skila. Okay?
Skila,
right, he's stoned to death. Yeah.
I'm curious about Srefa. I don't mean be morbid, but. For example, also
it doesn't mean being burnt at the stake.
That's also, become
no,
mani
it doesn't
fim.
Mean that.
Right. The mani fim also there. It says
Menoafim.
Tisari.
Yeah.
Also tisrapu. So that's they don't burn the entire body. They just pour this molten lead.
Right.
That's the meaning of it.
That's exactly what the punishment described in the Gemara in Sanhedrin. Mm-hmm. Right. It's correct. You have to realize burning at the stake. This, it's not a Jewish form of punishment, okay? Not a Jewish form of punishment. As much as possible, we have to bear in mind what I said before, that even with Malkos, that the Niklo Achicha V'Enecha, he still has to remain, you know, your brother, even after he suffered the punishment, right? So the same thing applies that to the idea that even a person who is executed, it has to be done as humanely as possible, and where it would not bring, what shall we say, disgrace. It's bad enough that it has to take place, but as the Torah says, "Ki kilalas elohim tolui," right? That it's a curse unto God, a person who is executed and hanged. In other words, it's a reflection on God Himself. God is disgraced by the actions of such a person. You understand? So that therefore we have to bury that person immediately after the execution, okay? And you know, so that the family will be spared the terrible anguish and pain which it's being, but at least you know that the pain and the suffering should not be multiplied in their case. Okay. Nope. Anyway, as we see, we are now plunged deeply into a lot of theoretical material over here, but I assure you that there are many, many beautiful things that we learned in the course of our study this year. So, with that, I think it's time to say a Kaddish to Rabbanan, and then we'll delve in Minchah. I'm surprised that the rabbis... Alright, so as we saw last week, just to review briefly, because bring Sam up to date, the Mishnah speaks about under what circumstances do we say that witnesses can become Edim Zomimim, which means that they can be refuted by witnesses who come and say that how could you give testimony when you were together with us in this place and at this particular time, at the time that you claim that you were elsewhere witnessing the event, you know, that you are testifying to, okay? And the Torah says that if a person, you know, that if witnesses come purposely and they lie in order to try to, you know, bring harm to another person, it might be a death penalty, or it might be even in a, let's say, a business transaction, whatever it may be. And it could apply, as we would say, to dini momenos, which means monetary affairs, you know, trials and so on and so forth, or disputes, or it could be in the fascists, where they come and they testify to somebody who would incur the death penalty on the basis of the original, that is, the first set of witnesses, so that the second set of witnesses are coming along in order to refute them. And what is the penalty of the first set of witnesses? So the Torah says that you have to do to them exactly the way they had purposed Zabam, which is the translation over there, the way they had purpose to do to their fellow men. Okay, now what the Mishnah over here is dealing with is the fact that while in theory this is a very fine idea, you know, that these witnesses can incur the same penalty which they had deliberately given testimony in order to convict whoever was the party that they were testifying against, and so they should suffer the same penalty that they were ready to inflict upon him. But we're going to see this evening that it cannot always be carried out to the letter of the law, that you have to sometimes change the penalty that they have. And what would be the changed penalty? The answer is that they would get malchus. Malchus means that they would be lashed, okay? Flogged, lashed, whatever term you want to use for it, and this is the penalty that they are given. Mm-hmm. And now the Mishnah then gives two different cases. Case of people who come and they say that the Kohen, that they are testifying against, is that they are imputing the fact that saying that he is not a real Kohen. Why? Because they say his mother was either a divorcee, right? He was a Ben Grusha, in other words, his mother was a divorcee, or his mother was a Chalutzo, which means that she had obtained release from her husband's brother, after her husband died and she was left childless, okay? That's what we call either chalitza or yibum. Yibum means that he actually marries her, and chalitza means that he doesn't marry her, but he has to give a release so that she'll be free to marry other people. Okay? Now, in either case, the offspring of a gerusha or a chalitza is automatically disqualified from being a kohen. And we added to that also last week the fact that we learned in Kedushin also that the mother had not been converted at the time or something like that, she was a convert, okay? So a kohen also is not permitted to marry a convert, okay? Therefore, should he marry a convert and they have offspring, then in that particular case, then what is the penalty for all those cases? The offspring becomes a cholol. Okay? And as a cholol, the offspring cannot enjoy the various benefits of being a kohen. It's not considered 100% kosher as a kohen. Okay? So that if these witnesses came and they testified and they said that this person is a cholol, his mother was not kosher to be married to a kohen, so are we going to say that these people, in case they themselves happen to be kohanim, that they should suffer the same penalty? In other words, that their children should be declared chalal? You understand? So we say, no, we can't do that. Why we can't do that, this we'll learn tonight. Okay? It's based, of course, upon technicalities. But what penalty should be inflicted upon them? The answer is that they get malchus for testifying falsely. And then they gave one other case, and that is that if they say that a person killed somebody and they said that it was accidental death, okay? And what is the penalty that the Torah prescribes if you kill somebody accidentally? So the answer is you have to go into exile to a city of refuge, lest the family avenger, the Goel Hadam, as the Torah says, would come and kill you. So you have to find refuge in a city of refuge, Yeran Niklot, right? And what happens if these people come, that is, these witnesses, and they say, we saw that he killed so-and-so, and granted, it was an accident, but nevertheless, he deserves what? To get the penalty of Golas. And then the next group of witnesses come and they say, these guys are a bunch of liars, right? Because they were with us at the time that they claimed to have seen it, so obviously the testimony cannot be true. And what is the penalty? Do they go into Golas? So the answer is, no, says the Mishnah. They do not get the penalty of Golas. So what penalty are they going to get after all? So they get Malkus. Okay, this is what the Mishnah says, all right? So the Gemara last week, as we saw, raised an objection about the language. It said, why does the Mishnah say that, how the witnesses become Zomimin? When really the Mishnah is telling us when the people who are Zomimin don't get the punishment of Zomimin. Right?
Zomimim is what I forget.
Yeah, the Zomimim are
false witnesses.
The false witnesses, okay. In this case, okay? They don't get it. So, how can they testify when at that particular time, they were, your witnesses were with us and so on? So, right? In that case, we learned at the end of the end of last week's discussion, I'll stop from right after the parenthesis that you see after the second parenthesis, right? Says, Tana Hosam Kai. The Gemara wants to explain what is this a follow up to. So it says, this really is a follow up to Gemara Sanhedrin, where, and again I'm summarizing very briefly what I said last week, there we speak about various death penalties that are meted out for different punishments, for murder, and for other violations, that the Torah says, that the person deserves, as for example, adultery or something like that, okay? Mm-hmm. That the person is liable to the death penalty. And there's a Mishnah which says that kol ha-zomim imakdim lo'osa mitzvah, that wherever these false witnesses you know, testify against a person and he deserves a particular death penalty, if it were true, you know, that he had committed, let's say they accused him of what? Let's say they accused him of having committed murder, okay? Then in that particular case, when it's proven that he did not commit murder, then they should get the penalty that would be prescribed for murder, okay? This is the theory behind it, okay? So that, for example, in the Gemara, penalty for murder happens to be herik. Herik means that, you know, they chop off his head, right, okay? Take a sword and chop off his head, sort of like, you know, Saudi Arabian style.
Saudi Arabians do, yeah.
Okay. Actually, however, you know, with the Gemara learned it from the Romans, actually. You have to realize this. Right, this was a Roman method of
execution. We use stoning most of the time.
Stoning is another penalty, but that's for a different type of infraction.
I mean, what I'm saying is that stoning was seemed to be the prevalent way of killing people in the...
That was one way.
Yeah.
That was one way.
This must have evolved through time, though. Do I understand that at one time they did give this severe penalty to the witness?
In theory, it could be inflicted, yes. Yes,
but it must
in
have
theory.
Evolved so that when these discussions came along...
Right. You're correct. Right. As I said last week, a lot of the material that we'll be learning is more in the nature of theoretical material, but there's an old principle that says, Drosh v'kabel schar, which means... study these laws and get a reward for studying, because even the intellectual exercise which is involved and understanding, you know, what is the motivation and what are the various dinim and so on, this too is a mitzvah. It's a mitzvah to learn, you see. So if we're learning in the realm of something which is a little bit far from us, but still we don't lose out, because it opens up new vistas in Jewish learning for us, okay? Mm-hmm. Not everything that we learn here can be applicable today, obviously. Mm-hmm. First of all, we no longer have any bezdin that can inflict the death penalty, okay? Secondly, a little bit later, towards the end of the chapter, we're going to learn that even in the days of the Sanhedrin, they had already restricted the entire business of death penalty. And third, if you study the Gemara Sanhedrin, where basically, you know, this is where most of the laws are, as far as the qualifications of judges, the qualifications of witnesses, and then what kind of penalties can the court inflict, we see over there that they're always, in the case of a punishment, capital punishment, where such a case might be involved, they're always trying to find zuchus, in other words, trying to find a reason to speak in favor of the person who was accused and see if they could come up with reasons for acquitting him as against chovah that is condemning that person. They always want to try to find out that, some of these things are very interesting when you compare them with American law as well.
They didn't have first degree and second degree murder.
Manslaughter
was equivalent to accidental murder.
Accidental murder is we'll be learning later on, too, as we continue with the study of Masechta, that even in accidental murder, there is a difference under the circumstances in which the murder took place. Whether it was done, you know, through negligence, let's say, or whether it couldn't be helped. In one case, if it was done through negligence, then as we learned, the punishment would be golus, so he has to go into exile into the city of refuge, okay? But where, let's say, there was absolutely unavoidable and there was no intention and no negligence on the part of the person, you know, who happened to slay another person accidentally, then in that particular case, right, he does not have to go into exile, okay? But we'll also see tonight that sometimes exile is looked upon from a different point of view. All right, so let's go on with what we're learning now, okay? All right. So it says then in the Gemara Sanhedrin that kol hazemim magim liyosam mitzvah, losam mitzvah, that you know those who testify falsely, that they should receive the same penalty of death as the one that they said, you know, that their testimony would have condemned the person to, if it weren't for the fact that the witnesses, that another set of witnesses came along and said, you know, that these were false witnesses, right? So Kotz Mizomim Beibatz Koine Goala. The exception would be if they testified falsely that the daughter of a Kohen had committed adultery with her lover. Okay? Why? Because in that case, because then the Zomimim would not get the same death penalty which would have been inflicted, but rather they would get a different death penalty. Why is that? Because in the case of the Bas Kohen, the Torah has an exception. It says over there, Bas Kohen, right? He seichel his nose if she profanes herself by becoming a prostitute or by sinning, you know, by committing adultery, then ba'esh tisoreif. Her punishment is sreifa, which I explained last week means that they put molten lead, you know. Doesn't mean that they burn them at the stake, but it means that they force molten lead down their throat. Okay? It's not a very nice penalty either, I mean, needless to say. But certainly it's not, you know, like being burnt at the stake the way so many of our Kedoshim were burnt at the stake by the great Christian practitioners of the religion of love, you know. Yeah. Pardon my sarcasm.
Mm-hmm.
But we mustn't lose sight of what has happened in the course of Jewish history. All right. So, to continue. Because she has one death penalty, whereas the Boel, that is the paramour, right, gets a different penalty, so obviously we cannot give the same penalty to the Adam Zomim. Okay. All right. So, since that's the case, it would seem that, you know, so far so good, right? To look at it from the point of view that, okay, we've established the idea that Adam Zomim should get the same penalty, right? But now along comes the Gemara and says, V'yesh Adam Zomim im Achirim, right? But there are other kinds of false witnesses, She'enosim behem din hazoma kol ikar, where you cannot carry out at all this penalty, namely that they should get exactly the same punishment or the same penalty that would have been given, you know, to the person whom they accused falsely. You can't carry it out at all. Elo malchus aboyim. But rather, what penalty will they have to suffer? That they have to get 40 lashes. And as I told you last week, 40 lashes doesn't mean 40 either.
You get 39.
The maximum right was 39, okay? But it's called 40 because it's a nice round number, okay? Yes. No. Only exceptional cases, right? Only an exceptional case, okay? The Bas Kohen is, this is right?
Well,
if she is an Arusa, she's already considered like a married woman. That's the point, right?
That was my question.
This is correct. Because of the fact that in those days, Arison already made her like a married woman. The only thing is she had not yet lived with her husband. So that in case, for example, of inheritance and things like that, you know, so there it might make a difference. I mean, she's entitled as an Usa ready to a Ksuba. There's no question about that. But, there are certain circumstances under which, you know, the law of an Arusa and the door, and the law of a Nesua, in other words, a woman who had actually started living together with her husband, would vary slightly. But you're right. I mean, that Erisin automatically made the woman a nation's issue. From that point on.
But Bat Kohen, who is Levada, would this apply? Would she also?
What do you mean, Levada?
She was not. She's just a single woman. She's just a young
woman. No.
She wouldn't be burned.
That's right. No, that wouldn't apply at all.
Okay.
That particular case, you know, she is what we would call a Pinuya. In other words, she's, you know, there are no marital ties at all involved in her, so it's not adultery in the same sense. Doesn't mean that it's kind of conduct to be commended, but the penalty at best, you know, might be malchus, but malchus for a different purpose than what we're learning over here.
Right.
Because malchus could also be applied by a bezdin if they felt that moral standards were such that the community needed a lesson by strictness. I mean, it's sort of like the idea in Singapore, you know, where they took this kid, you know, and they gave him lashes. Because this way, they keep the populace in line, so that they don't do drug dealing and things like that. Okay, I see in Saudi Arabia, they simply chop off their head if they catch them with that. There was in our local paper just a few days ago.
Yes.
Good. But, you know...
Less hours to worry about.
But Malkus could be applied only, as we would say, you know, in order to enforce a moral code or something like that. But, you know, not for... certainly the death penalty would never be given for anything like that. Okay.
Good. Thank you. I appreciate that.
Yeah. All right. Now, Ketzad. Give me an example, says the Gemara. So, all right, the Eden on the Beish Plaini, all right, we testify, along come these false witnesses, and they say, we testify against so-and-so, Shehu ben Grusha ben Chalutza, right? Mm-hmm. That he is the son of a divorced woman. Of course, he's a Kohen, but he is a Kohen who's the son of a divorced woman, divorcee, or a woman had received Chalutza. So, Einom Yeh says, ben Grusha ben Chalutza Tartov. So, we do not say that this man, that is the mazim, in other words, the person who brings this false testimony, therefore immediately is punished by being declared a ben gerusha or ben chalutza, assuming of course he's a kohen instead. Ela lokes harboyim, right? But he gets the 40 lashes. So the Gemara wants to know, menohane milay, where do you find, for example, in the Torah, a reference to something like this? Usually Menohane Mili means, you know, where can I find something in the text in the Torah, you know, which supports this point of view. So Omar Rabbi Yehoshua ben Levi, so he says the Omar Kro, says the Pasuk says as follows. It says Vatsisem lo ka'asher zoma, that you shall do unto him even as he purposed to do, right? But what does he lay the stress on? He lays the stress upon the word lo. He says, the Torah says lo, which means to him, you can do it, right? But velo lizaro, you cannot do it to his descendants, to his children. You cannot, declare that he is a ben grusha ben chalutza, because what would it do to his own children? It would make them also as chalalim, and it's not so. It's not so, you can't do it. So, for that reason, he needs a punishment. So what punishment? So, okay. So, let him suffer the malchus. So now the Gemara says, alright, so maybe we should then say, alright, let's say that we make him personally possible. In other words, we'll say, alright, this guy is a cholo, right? But we're not going to punish his children by declaring them cholo. Now, that wouldn't make sense, says the Gemara. It says, Be'inon kashesam la'sois. Torah says that we require that you have to do unto him even as he purposed to do. The lekha. And in this case, you can't do it.